This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The political aftershocks are strong and many. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's unexpected death on Saturday caused an election year earthquake that's going to rattle Washington for some time to come. You've heard and will continue to hear analysis on that. We also wanted to hear from people who personally knew the sharp-witted justice well. Scalia, of course, graduated from Harvard Law School, and there are many people in the Boston area who worked with him, who clerked for him, who even withstood his cutting questioning during oral argument before the High Court. But perhaps few people knew Antonin Scalia better than Ronald Cass. He's Dean Emeritus of the Boston University School of Law and Justice Scalia's close friend for 39 years.
He's just an enormous loss for everyone who knew him. He was a gregarious, friendly, outgoing person who loved to joke, loved to laugh, had a great sense of humor, occasionally a little bit of a sly sense of humor. But he was someone who would share that with you on all kinds of occasions, sometimes appropriate ones.
We spoke with Ronald Cass earlier today, and we talked about Scalia's legacy, about conversations they'd had about constitutional originalism, or textualism, as Scalia called it. And Dean Cass also shared some favorite memories of his longtime friend.
One thing that was always a little bit of an annoyance to Nino was the fact that there were people who had trouble pronouncing his last name. When he would talk to people, he would always explain that it was very important when you addressed a justice to get his name right. One time we were traveling back from a trip we were on together, and we were on an airplane. The flight attendant came over to Justice Scalia and said to him, "Mr. Scalia, what can I offer you?" And Nino very quickly said, "The name is Scalia." The flight attendant said, "You mean like the Supreme Court justice?"
Oh,
and he said, "Yes, exactly like that."
Oh, dear. Oh my! And did he leave it at that?
Yes, he left it at that. He was not going to explain who he was. It was a lot of fun to be with him. It was a lot of fun to travel with him, and a lot of fun to know him.
Well, I'm wondering if you could help walk us through Justice Scalia's own development as a legal scholar and a legal mind, because, I mean, as everyone listening to this well knows, Justice Scalia was the most famous and highest profile originalist or textualist, as he called it. Did you ever have conversations where he described to you what it was that took him in that direction when it came to his view of the true meaning and intent of the Constitution?
We talked a lot less about the evolution of his views than we did about the background sort of considerations. Obviously, he was someone who was a very strong believer in the rule of law. He is someone who came from a background where learning and taking text seriously was important. His father was a professor, and he grew up knowing languages and being very concerned with law. But more than that, as someone who had studied classics, studied theology, studied government, he was someone who believed deeply in being governed by law, not being governed by will, and saw the Constitution and the laws that come from it as being rooted in the notion that there is a process for making rules, there is a process for setting them out, and anything we do, whether as judges or scholars, should be respectful of the process and what it means to be governed by law.
Mm. You know, the New York Times pointed out that a lot of Justice Scalia's legal thinking was put forth to the nation in the form of his dissents. And I'm wondering, did he ever talk to you about that, that he wrote a lot of dissents that seemed to have a great amount of impact?
Well, he would rather have had his most influential writing be in majorities than dissents. But the dissents often had an impact on future development of the law. One of his early notable dissents was in the Independent Counsel case, Morrison against Olson, where he was the lone dissenter. And he wrote a dissent that did two things. One, it showed the sort of wit that he had. He had a line in there, as I recall, where he said, a lot of difficult things come to us as a wolf in sheep's clothing, but the problem here comes to us as a wolf dressed as a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
This is he was very, very good at finding ways of encapsulating his thoughts. The other thing about the Morrison dissent is that the dissent there, which no one else joined, became the majority on a number of points, including just a few years later on precisely the question of how you know who is and who is not an officer who has to be presidentially appointed and senatorially confirmed.
Right. So the transformation of, in terms of the influence of his thinking vis-a-vis how one interprets the Constitution, is pretty profound. I mean, because, again, I'm looking at how the New York Times remembers it, and they said by the time he wrote his most important majority opinion, finding that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms, even the dissenters were engaged in trying to determine the original meaning of the Constitution, the approach that he had championed. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about how his thinking really transformed how people even approached arguing cases before the court.
Well, he was a textualist, which is a little bit different than an originalist. He believed that the meaning of the term was embodied in the text as it was understood when it was adopted. So you didn't actually engage in psychoanalysis of the people who wrote it, but he did care a lot about what it was people had agreed to. And what Nino thought is that that is what law is. It's something that we understand to bind us. We have to have some form of agreement as to what it is. We have to have some form of common understanding of what the words are that we use. That notion was profoundly different than the theories that were dominant when he became a judge, first on the Court of Appeals and then on the Supreme Court. And his view really has set the pattern for discourse ever since.
However, Ronald Cass would admit that even if Scalia's view set the pattern for discourse, it did not set the pattern for decision-making on the Supreme Court. Take, for example, the recent landmark case legalizing gay marriage. During oral argument in April just last year, Scalia offered a clear view into the nature of his eventual dissent. Here he is questioning Boston lawyer Mary Bonato, who was arguing in favor of same-sex marriage.
The issue, of course, is not whether there should be same-sex marriage, but who should decide the point.
Yes, and we're very...
You're asking us to decide it for this society when no other society until 2001 ever had it. And how many states have voted to have same-sex marriage, or their legislature, or by referendum? I think it's 11, isn't it?
Yes, but I would also count the state courts that interpret their constitutions.
Well, yes, the state courts who agree with you. But once again, that's not the people deciding it. It's judges deciding.
And ultimately, the justices on the nation's highest court decided in a 5-4 ruling that same-sex marriage is legal. Scalia wrote a dissent so fiery, you could almost feel the pages burn as you read it. I asked Ronald Cass what he made of it. His dissent was classic Scalia. I mean, he wrote that he believed that the majority was ruling in a pretentious, egoistic, and profoundly incoherent manner. And he later on in his dissent wrote that today's decree that my ruler and the ruler of 320 million Americans coast to coast is a majority of the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court. Did you talk about that case with him at all?
We talked about pretty much everything. We had a lot of time that we spent together to share views on various things. But obviously, the things that he said about the cases that he wanted to be public were things he said in the cases. And I don't think that anyone would accuse him of hiding his viewpoints. or sugarcoating what it was that he believed, even when he was writing from the bench.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. He definitely didn't sugarcoat anything. I'm looking at another part of the Obergefell dissent, and he wrote, "Whoever thought that intimacy and spirituality, whatever that means, were freedoms. And if intimacy is, one would think freedom of intimacy is abridged rather than expanded by marriage. Ask the nearest hippie." If I may, did he ever talk to you about the criticisms that he fielded from, I don't know how to put it, lack of a better term, more people who took more a liberal view of the Constitution?
Well, we talked a lot about a variety of things, including some of his critics. He spent more of his time thinking about what the right arguments were than who was unhappy with the way he was doing it.
Mm-hmm. We should also note that his approach to the Constitution didn't always please conservative politicians, for example, because I'm looking at his record on cases involving criminal defendants and sentencing, which politically one might think that you could predict what Justice Scalia would think, but that wasn't necessarily the case at all.
Well, not just sentencing, but also the confrontation clause, the right to confront witnesses against you. He was true to his view of how to read the law, not to any one political outcome. Obviously, his way of reading the law is a way that is conservative in the old-fashioned meaning of the term. It means it's really rooted in conserving what it is we have. He thought that was the role of the courts, and the politicians could make changes. The politicians could change the laws, write new statutes, amend the Constitution, but his job was to give it a faithful reading to what it said. And sometimes that pleased people on one side of the political aisle, sometimes it displeased them, but that wasn't his primary concern.
If I may, last couple of questions for you, Dean Cass. What was Justice Scalia's view of the purpose of the court in modern America?
Well, his view of the purpose of the court in modern America is the same as the purpose of the court when it was a new institution. The role of the court is to say what it is the law means as written, what it is that the understanding of the words that are used was when it was adopted, and not to try to figure out whether that makes the world a better or worse place. Those are things that are left to the political branches for good reason. I know that there are people who always view every pronouncement from a Supreme Court justice through a political lens. Most of the justices, whether they were agreeing with Justice Scalia or disagreeing with him, really recoil at that. And whether they're on the right or the left, the justices don't want a court that looks like a political institution. That was something that was central to Justice Scalia's thinking about the law and about the role of the court.
Mm. And yet now we find ourselves in a moment where politics is swirling about the court in a maelstrom, because there's this big fight going on vis-a-vis should President Obama appoint or nominate a new justice now or not. I mean, what do you make of that?
It's not a surprise that a moment like this is bound up in politics, but what he would have wanted is for the focus to be on making sure the court as an institution is what it was he hoped it would always be.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dean Cass, if I may just ask, you shared such a wonderful story a little earlier about Justice Scalia and the flight attendant. I'm wondering if there's another favorite memory that you have that you might leave us with.
Well, we were teaching in Europe at one point, and we're traveling together. And he was a very enthusiastic driver. There was one time we were heading back over what we had thought was a fairly nice stretch of road that turned out to be a little more challenging. And he drove reassuring everyone the entire time that really there was nothing to worry about, despite the absence of guardrails, despite the sheer drops near where we were, despite the hairpin turns. And then we got to the end, he put the car in park, looked at my wife, who had been offering opinions of this ride the whole time, and said, yeah, you know, that was a little more difficult than I expected. He did it with the sort of smile and an almost cherubic look that I think was typical of him in many moments and encapsulated sort of the inner glow he had that was shared with friends and family for so many years.
Well, Ronald Cass is Dean Emeritus of the Boston University School of Law. He's president of Cass and Associates, and he knew Justice Antonin Scalia for 39 years. Dean Cass, my most sincere thanks for joining us today, and once again, I'm so sorry for your loss, but I appreciate you sharing this time with us.
Thank you again.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio Boston.